This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Green.
Hard to believe, but it's been more than 16 weeks since Nancy Guthrie was taken from her home. More than 100 days now. I mean, we're almost damn near half a year in. No arrest, no named suspect, and somewhere the person responsible has maybe, again, I say maybe, been living, maybe not, probably looks like a normal life. The evidence points to a burglary gone catastrophically wrong. Someone who walked in for something and left with an outcome that they could never undo. That was one night, but every day since has really required its own set of choices. What to do with the evidence? Who to avoid? Whether to run? Whether to talk? That's assuming the person is still alive. And that's the operative point that we're going to be going from today, because it's not so beneficial to talk about what a corpse would be doing if, in fact, that person is gone. Joining us to discuss, as always, Robin Drake, retired FBI Special Agent, Chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program. And it is Wednesday, so psychotherapist Siobhan Scott and author is... also with us to help us break down where this is all going. Siobhan has spent more than 30 years working with violent offenders in forensic settings, studying not just why people commit acts of violence, but what happens to them afterwards, the decisions, the deterioration, the psychological machinery that either holds or breaks. And we're all kind of wondering what's going to happen here. Siobhan, the act itself, it was one night. But in 16 weeks since, the person who did this has to make a lot of decisions. If there's evidence, what to do with it? And obviously, Nancy was evidence. How to account for their time, whether to stay, whether to run, whether to talk, whether to stay silent, act normal, don't act normal, keep doing what you're doing, don't keep doing what you're doing. Each one of these decisions deepens their involvement from a standpoint of your own, a clinical standpoint. What is that post-crime decision cascade do to someone psychologically? I mean, does each choice make it easier to keep going, or is it harder as time goes on for someone who did something like this, assuming there's one person involved here?
Yeah. I will, you know, because of course you can get a lot of different personality types and people that commit crimes. I'm going to sort of simplify it. Mm-hmm. And the way I would categorize it, you could have two kinds of people potentially involved here. One would be a person with very psychopathic tendencies, somebody who's kind of a career criminal, maybe not something this big, but they've done a lot of burglaries, they've done a lot of crimes, and this is kind of a lifelong pattern for them. The other kind of person would be, this is an anomaly. This is for whatever reason, they got involved in something and they're not psychopathic. Let's just say they're more of an average everyday person. And I think those two types of people would handle it very differently, because a person who's got psychopathic tendencies can compartmentalize really well. They don't have a lot of anxiety. In fact, what we know about folks like that, their emotional center of the brain, the part of the brain, you know, the amygdala, that's the part where fear and anxiety responses are generated. And psychopathic people have a much smaller amygdala. So they don't feel a lot of anxiety when committing crimes. They don't get nervous. It's a lot more methodical for them. And so they're going to just be carrying on with life. And they've, you know, done what they need to do as far as they can see, and they're not really going to be affected by it. In fact, they may enjoy the attention that they're seeing in the media. The other kind of person is going to be really hypervigilant and anxious and suffering right now. And, you know, we don't know what kind of person we have here, but it could go either way.
Based on what we're seeing with the very limited data, Siobhan, of Porch Guy and the very limited data points we're having on what we see there with movements, with behavior, with clothing, do you have a venture, a conjecture, or a guess on what you think we're dealing with? Especially not just there, but then in what we're not hearing in the aftermath afterwards.
Yeah, since this was a very bold thing to do, however, you know, effectively he pulled it off, I'm not sure, because there's been, you know, we've discussed how sophisticated was it with the management of, you know, putting the bush over the camera and all that kind of stuff. Was this really a pro? But my guess is it's somebody that has committed a lot of crimes before to do something this bold. And so this is probably a person with more psychopathic tendencies who's really standing back and just going on with his regular day job, whatever that may be, and not losing any sleep over it.
So not a lot of leakage. And most likely, too, then if we're dealing with someone that can compartmentalize well, we'll go. I'm just also commenting on the Savannah Guthrie messaging that they did out, you know, great messaging hitting different types of people. But one of the messages I think were very methodical and pragmatic was, say, just do X, Y, and Z for X, Y, and Z. Then you had the empathetic appeal. So I'm guessing no real appeal when you have the empathetic appeal then.
They wouldn't be moved by that.
I want to ask about the wrench theory. Have you heard the wrench theory that's going on right now, where it's basically it can kind of tie, can kind of not in this, just like everything. There's elements that can kind of do it. Wrench theory is basically a wrench attack is what it's called, is when someone goes in and attacks somebody to get cryptocurrency, either directly from their victim that they're going after, or that victim is close enough to someone who has a crypto wallet that can be influenced to give them their money, basically just through a password. Wrench attack, because it's $5 for a wrench and doesn't require super scientific or super in-depth planning or a huge consortium of people to go in and rob a bank to get millions of dollars or something. It takes a $5 wrench and threatening someone. This has been happening quite a bit in the last 2 years. There's studies on it. It's certainly going up. There was a wrench attack in Scottsdale, Arizona, the day she went missing, which is about 70 miles or so from where she is. Again, these attacks have gone in. They try and get money from people. It's typically young people who are, I guess, recruitable, if you will, online to go and be this kind of this, what was the word you guys used in the FBI, Robin, for kind of the mope, the moat, the what?
The mope,
basically, M-O-P-E, if you will.
Mope.
The M-O-P-E for some higher power that's in another country that's never going to get in trouble for any of this. They're recruiting somebody over here. Kind of a nihilistic thinking person, if you will, that doesn't have much to live for, that they're going to go in, they're going to do this, they're going to get the money, they're going to get their cut, and they're going to be out. And that's it. That's all there is to it. But if the person gets caught, then it's on them. And the higher source that's recruiting these nihilistic, idiotic people that feel they have nothing to live for, but maybe they'll go cash in on this. If they get caught, then it's on them. That's something that some people are looking at here. I don't know how well it applies. What I'm more thinking about, though, is nihilism and that way of thinking and that way of just not feeling there's a whole lot to live for, that there's not a whole lot of purpose to life. That, I mean, it's essentially the way I would kind of describe it is people that it's like you're a live game player of Grand Theft Auto running about the mm-hmm. world, doing whatever you want to do. Mm-hmm. And the world is your murder simulator or simulator mm-hmm. to whatever you want to do. What if we're dealing with that type of a person? And what type of a person is a nihilistic person? That term's getting thrown around a lot. Is that someone that would fall into like the sociopathy area, psychopathy, narcissism? I mean, it's a very interesting way of looking, but it seems there are, you know, a lot of people who kind of feel that have that outlook on life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wouldn't see narcissism with that, because a narcissist would probably be the opposite,
okay.
You know, of very self-aggrandizing, and I'm very important, and I want people to mm-hmm. recognize how important I am. So I would describe the more nihilistic kind of person who will commit a crime, as somebody who's more depressive and just feels like none of it matters. Mm-hmm. So screw it. Let's just go for it and see what happens. And they don't have any moral compass. They don't have integrity. But it's more of, you know, you just think of somebody who's just kind of flat and down and out. That would be my guess.
Would that type of a person fit something like this? I mean, would that type of a person be someone that would be recruitable for a mission of this sort?
I wouldn't see that.
No.
And I'm just going with my gut here.
Yeah.
I would see somebody who's, you know, if we were looking at the narcissistic psychopath person, someone more like that.
Okay.
Because it takes a certain boldness to go into a house and, you know, whether they intended to kidnap her or, you know, as we've speculated at times, did she just pass away during, you know, the burglary, if that's what was going on, or was there an intent to kidnap her? This is somebody who's, I think, very bold and very, you know, lacking the normal sense of anxiety that a normal person would have about doing something like this. So it's a very active kind of thing where I mm-hmm. think a more nihilistic person is a person who doesn't want to put out a lot of energy for committing a crime.
Not a lot of, they don't want to put a lot of energy out, but they also don't have much regard for what they do put out.
No.
I guess that's where I'm like, Are we looking at the wrong area here? Are we thinking too traditional, if you will, too much in the classic form of mm-hmm. folks who kidnap old people? Mm-hmm. You know, is it? I mean, because there is that way of thinking out there. But you do make some good points, because the motor is a key aspect of that. And if they don't have much of a motor, they're just kind of then you don't usually have it. But I could see, you know, two types of people going into that house to doing that: a very bold person who thinks, or just doesn't give a shit at all. You know, like it could almost be like two different ends of the spectrum to a certain extent, but very extreme. Robin, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No, not at all. I'm just kind of fleshing through all these different personality types as we're seeing, you know, kind of overlaying them on what we have seen and what we haven't seen since. I'm definitely on the side of more nihilistic as well, because, you know, like Siobhan said, someone who's high on the look at me spectrum, basically, we'd have leakage afterwards. And I'm also going to do, let's start with the presumption that this person's still alive, because if they're dead, you know, we won't get any leakage anywhere. So I'm also on that psychopathic side as well, just because, you know, it's more transactional. Life is more transactional. But I'm thinking about that nihilistic side with, like, well, who cares? No big deal. As a personality type that would do this, I don't think so. Again, just from the limited data we have from Porch Guy, because what he was wearing and what we saw and the behaviors we saw could be very flippant, like no reaction to anything, very fluid with what he was doing on that porch and what we saw beforehand. But again, that could be because what Siobhan said, this individual had reps, as we've said before, and doing this before, so he's comfortable doing it. But the amount of planning with what he wore is above and beyond what I typically see on these things. So that's not someone who I would imagine would be very flippant about, hey, no big deal, I don't care too much. They cared enough to not be found by what they're presenting there. And I think not being found at this point has less to do with him as it does with the investigation. And so I'm still going on the side of what we're saying with most likely higher in psychopathy, career guy. And career, you know, it's an interesting word, isn't it, in this kind of thing. Had reps doing this before, and things went sideways.
Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts this far in? Now, more than 100 days in, we have nothing, publicly at least, of this being a one-man job? Or do you think that the more people involved, the more leakage you likely could have? That somebody at this point, there's a million some dollars on the line. If somebody opens up their mouth and says, I was involved in some way, shape, or form, or I have information. I mean, hell, we've seen many cases where people are intimately involved in the crime, but if they're the ones that blow the whistle on it, they get the money and they get out of jail free card. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of people who basically have that option right now to become a millionaire overnight. If this was some sort of a group activity. What are your thoughts on that being deeper than just this one guy at this point with the lack of anything that we've seen so far, Siobhan?
Mm-hmm. Well, you're right. And having a co-conspirator raises the threat of disclosure. And it's, again, it's possible, but considering that she was 84 years old, I think it's also possible that one person with a plan could have just done it.
Yeah.
I'm 50-50. Let's for a second, I'll go down our coffin defer road of bigger group organization, hired a mope and in. With, again, cascading on what Siobhan just said, if you had a mope that was hired hand to do this, there'd be leakage. So my guess is if you're going to go down that road, that 50%, then whoever was the hired hand, that mope on porch, he was bumped off afterwards because he blew it, and you can't have leakage. So if that's a large organization, because you can't hide crap this long in large organizations, it just doesn't work because people have leakage. It just happens. And so then on the other side is solo guy, burglary, or intent to take something in the home. I'm very open-ended on that, whether it was Nancy or something else targeted in that house. I always been saying something in that house was targeted for taking. And if it's a one person, then if they're on the high psychopathy scale, like Siobhan was saying, there wouldn't be any leakage. They've moved on. It went sideways. Next. Mm-hmm. So I think if it's the other side, that person was killed or is dead, in my estimation, because there would be leakage. And if it's the other side, it's one person. Mm-hmm. That's my theory.
Yeah. It's hard to know. Obviously, with such limited information, we're still filling in the gaps. Mm-hmm. Both of you, I'll go with Siobhan first. We're this far in, we haven't gotten anything. Do you see this thing being solved? Solved, because there'll be a trial if they catch somebody, if they're alive. Do you see them having a person in custody by the end of 2026? In your opinion?
I would sure love to. We all would love to. So, yeah, I'll have to say 50-50 on that one, too. Something could break. There may be something going on behind the scenes that we don't know about. And it's got to be just hell on the family. And I'm sure the neighbors are terrified. And it would be wonderful to have something. But, yeah, as you say, I haven't followed really closely all the problems with the mm-hmm. investigation, mm-hmm. but it sure sounds like it's not been the best, and that concerns me.
Robin?
So, and actually, I'm going to go back to one of our viewers. Like, they commented on another podcast, and I'm seeing this on other shows as well, that that someone's theorizing that the investigators have the name already. They just don't know which name it is because they have a large pile. I tend to believe that. I'm probably up at like 75-80% that somewhere in a massive data pile between all the people at Walmart that bought these things, all the people that purchased the types of guns like this, all these potential names, I do think that the perpetrator's in there somewhere. I think it's going to come down to the energy that the investigations have to create a filter that gives us that name. I don't know if they have that energy, but I do think that somewhere in that pile, there's knowledge, because we have enough data to say where that material came from, where the clothing came from, and it just, do you have the right filter to get to it? So by the end of 2026, I don't know. I really think it's going to come down to, again, the energy and the coordination takes to sift through mm-hmm. a lot of mm-hmm. receipts, a lot of people, mm-hmm. And that's what we don't know.
I mean, I kind of agree there. This will be a throwback to those of us who remember a product called the phone book. every city had a phone book. Every city's is different size based on your population. There's a list of a lot of people in there, and I can guarantee a bunch of them have murdered people. But what's the filter to figure it out? I feel like that's where we're sitting. We have a phone book.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And what are we, how are we going to filter?
It always comes down to that. It's the quality of filter. And that's what profilers do. That's what the behavioral team does. So you have a bunch of unsubs and a bunch of potential people. And this is what profilers do when they come in. And you, the investigation team gives the behavioral people, hey, here's all the data. Here's everything we have. Create a profile, which is creating a filter for who would potentially commit something like this from the data we have and the observations. Then once you have a filter, you then take that filter and then overlay it with all the potential names you have. And then you have a more reduced filter. Then you start conducting interviews and investigation with this narrow filter. So do they have enough to do that? I don't know. You know, so that's, and what they're sharing with that, like people are commenting Nanos' involvement. Who knows, man, because there's such chaos, I think, going on behind the scenes, but they got a lot of data from a lot of things. Do they have enough filters to go through it?
And I'm wondering, have they, and you know, I hope so, and it would seem obvious to do that, but anybody who had contact with her, somebody mentioned in the comments, maybe a church member, any kind of handyman, yard work. I mean, there's so many cases of elderly people victimized because somebody came in a year before and replaced a window in their house or something like that. I hope that all of those people have been looked at.
You'd think they have. I mean, I'm assuming they all have been.
And
I know the neighborhood, Jen was saying this the other day on the show, you know, the neighborhood's been canvassed and re-canvassed like multiple times as you get more things in. So they get exhausted from regurgitating the same thing. And at this point, actually, it's a good follow-on question to this for you, Siobhan. At what point do false memories or... not necessarily false memories, or implanted memories start happening to people you're interviewing because of all the media attention it's getting and for conjecture you're seeing? You know, like our listeners are commenting this, and this. We take this in. We don't remember exactly where we get it. We kind of synthesize it with this. At what point does that become a problem?
Yeah, I think it's always a huge problem. People, we can just say misremembering, or they have a bias, you know, and it's got to be hell to sift through all of it. I mean, it's a lot of work, and they need to devote a lot of energy to it.
Well, and if you're just the average person there, a neighbor of Nancy's, you're wanting to find an answer.
Yes.
So your brain is sitting there racking itself going, was there any weird noises that night? Did I see a car drive by? And then that's where you get into the dangerous territory as more and more time goes by of misremembering things or your brain manufacturing things
to help wild ideas.
Yeah, I mean, to fit a narrative, not that you're wanting to misrepresent anything, but because you're actively trying and your brain is trying to do its best. And we're not the greatest at deciphering what's fact from fiction when it comes from right here. So,
because all we want to do as a human being is we want to understand and feel safe. And so in lack of data, we create data. And again, something we do as a species more than anything else on this planet does, as we find patterns where patterns don't even necessarily exist. And when you start seeing patterns, this is where conspiracy theories come from. I mean, every time one of these cases pops up, this is what people start doing. They start trying to create patterns to understand things before you actually have facts and data. And then it's why all these boom, 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 boom. And this is where leadership and people like Nanos are supposed to step in and help people not do that. Not stamp it down because then people just fight back, but help them work through what you're actually doing so you understand it, so you can stop doing it, so you can keep focusing on facts, data, and details. So that's where real leads come from.
Well said.
Thanks. Well, I think he loses his job in 2027, so we can start investigating it then.
A whole new set of
hopefully there's answers before then. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. The links are in the description. Let's talk about this case. Anna Kempner was 18 years old, a high school senior in Titusville, Florida. In November of 2025, she boarded a Carnival cruise ship with her blended family, the fun ships. Her dad, Christopher, her stepmother, Chantel, her grandparents, and Chantel's two kids from the previous marriage, including a 16-year-old stepbrother named Timothy Hudson. Anna and Timothy weren't blood related. They were part of the blended family. Chantel is Timothy's biological mother and Anna's stepmother. Pay attention to the roles of people here because it gets confusing.
Say it one more time again.
Okay. Chantel is Timothy's biological mother and Anna's stepmother. So she's the mother of the alleged killer, the 16-year-old. She's married to Anna's father, on that cruise, Anna and Timothy were placed in a cabin together without the parents. Anna was found dead under her bed, wrapped in a blanket covered with life preservers. Timothy Hudson has since been charged as an adult in federal court with first-degree murder and aggravated SA crimes in connection with her death. He's pled not guilty. But today we're not here to talk about the criminal case. We're here to talk about what happened inside this family afterward and before, because the court filings tell a story that raises questions a jury will never be asked to answer. Joining us to discuss, psychotherapist Siobhan Scott. Siobhan, I want to set the table here with the family structure, and I know I just kind of went over it. You got Chantel Hudson, Timothy's biological mother here. She's also Anna Kempner's stepmother. She's married to Anna's father, Christopher Kempner. They are still together today. After Anna was found dead on that ship, court filings show that Chantel and Christopher expelled Timothy from their household immediately. Okay, not a bad move. You got the guy that's accused of essaying and killing the daughter of your new husband, and it's your son. Probably not a good idea to have him in the same house as the other kids. Mm-hmm. Neither of them, however, have allegedly seen them since. Timothy's biological father, Thomas Hudson, Chantel's ex-husband, put a text exchange into the court record where he wrote, "I kept my mouth shut when you told me that you can't jeopardize your marriage for helping your son." Okay. Interesting take, but it does somewhat track with some of the testimony that we had seen in family court from Chantel and her distancing herself from her own son. It doesn't necessarily also read like a mother horrified by what her son allegedly did. It reads like a mother who has assessed what was standing, or that what standing by him was actually going to cost her, and decide that it wasn't worth it, in my opinion. It's an interesting dynamic that we're seeing right now. Parents walking away, not out of disgust, but are they walking away out of self-preservation, or is it pure disgust? I don't know. I don't know how I would be processing this as a parent if I were in this sort of a dynamic of a situation, but I do find it rather odd, the sheer whitewashing, or not let's say white, but just washing him out of the family. She's still with the dad, and the son's off to the wolves, basically. I don't know. It feels weird to me. Everybody grieves and deals with this sort of shit differently. There's no how to deal with your son murdering your stepdaughter for dummies book at Walden Books. So I don't know how one really processes this, but what's your take here? What is your take on the dynamics of this family of essentially he's dead to me?
It's super complicated, complicated. And yeah, to really weigh in accurately, we'd need to know a lot more about the history and the relationships. I have seen teenage boys do terrible things, rape, mm-hmm. murder. As we know, they can murder their parents. I mean, we don't know what has this family been through with this young guy. And we still think of a 16-year-old as a kid. They can be the size of a full-grown man and pretty scary. And I've seen 16-year-old boys beat their mothers and, just terrible, terrible things. Murdering another family member is it's mind-boggling, that people have to try and adjust to how do we cope with this. Mm-hmm. So I can understand still loving your son, but saying, I just emotionally have to disengage from this, and I have to, you want the best for him. But on the other hand, it could be psychological preservation for her to have some distance and say, I don't want to attend a trial. I'm just not up to trying to manage this anymore. And so it could be just a survival strategy for mm-hmm. her. And I don't know. I always put myself, how would I handle something like this? A little hard to imagine.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, we did that thought experiment yesterday. And that's why I'm curious about your take on this, Siobhan. So say this, because I'm curious about the history of the accused, you know, Timothy's behavior prior to this, if the parents' reaction is indicative of that in any way. So let's remove any legal counsel the parents were given and just take it from the face value of, all right, Timothy's accused of killing the stepsister, parents kick him out, and that's what I was looking up. He's living with the uncle right now, supposedly.
Yeah.
So based on that fact data we have, is that, because again, my thought experiment was, if this was a one-off and a spike from the norm that they hadn't seen before, as opposed to, hey, this has been a long growing trend and problem area for us, which way are you seeing this?
Well,
if any, from one small data set.
Right. My guess is that there has been some pretty aberrant behavior, you know, because you don't usually move from just being a normal kid with normal interests and activities to murdering your stepsister. And then all the other allegations that, you know, he's been aggressive with her, made her feel threatened before. And who knows what they've tried to intervene that just hasn't worked. And so my guess is it's not a one-off, just because people usually don't just go from normal to murder, right? Mm-hmm. And they may just not have felt like they had a lot of options. And I think I just go back to, you can still love your kid, but not be up to handling it anymore and just feel overwhelmed and threatened, and that it's not good for the other kids. And it's like, we just need him separate from us and we need some space and distance.
Yeah. Cause my thought experiment on it was, again, so definitely on the kid's side, this was an arc, you know, this wasn't just a one-off from everything we're seeing. And again, like you said, but I was curious about assessing the parents' awareness of this arc as well through the optic of their actions. Because if they didn't know of anything else going beforehand, and all of a sudden, again, let's place ourselves in this, we all have kids, what would your reaction be? Like you said, Siobhan, me, I'd be in disbelief at first. I'd be like, what the hell's going on? I'd get closer for a period of time as I'm trying to understand what made them do this. Mm-hmm. This isn't you. This is I don't get it. You know, you'd just be deeply disturbed and what, I mean, just see my, just like this, there's the same reaction. You get closer to try to figure out, as opposed to the final straw of like, I've had it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, anyway.
I'm finding everybody's actions here and, dare I say, performance in some of this rather troubling, because at the beginning of all this, if these allegations are true, there's outside sources, her ex-boyfriend, the ex-boyfriend's father, saying they warned the family about this kid and nothing was done. Okay. And nothing was done. If that's what happened. So they could, Chantel and Anna's father could have been saying, oh shit, like the chickens have finally come home to roost. We've been warned about this all this time. Mm-hmm. And now look how out of control this has gotten. And I'm sure if you're a parent, you're looking at that going, there's so much more we should have done.
Yeah.
But didn't. Now, I'm not saying that makes them killers. I'm not saying it makes them responsible for their crazy son's actions if he did this. But it certainly is not a good look.
No.
It certainly is something that you wouldn't necessarily, I think, want to hang your hat on or have following you around. And I'm finding the actions after the fact, going onto social media and posting words like, you know, they're looking for nails in the coffin on Timothy and things of that nature, a bit much for a family affair. Like, why are we projecting this shit out into the world? I mean, everybody, I guess, does now, but I don't. But a lot of people do. It seems performative. It seems I'm going to tell you who I am in this, not what the evidence or my track record shows you I am in this. I'm going to make a stand. And maybe they are making, maybe this is the wake-up call they needed. So this chaos doesn't ensue, the rest of their family are in that house. But it just feels performative to me. And again, I could be completely off. Maybe there is a mixture of some performance going on here for self-preservation. At the same time, grief and loss and hate and anger. It's probably a bit of everything that's going on.
Yeah.
Without a doubt. But it just, I don't know. It feels a bit off. Let's get to the area of the fact that they're still married. I mean, I know they just got married, and then we're hearing some of the wording here of to protect the marriage and the relationship and all that. And they want nails in the coffin for the son. That's, you know, a few days ago, they were the fucking three amigos and everything's fine and dandy. The fact that this has shifted so dramatically, so quickly, with these people, and a full reversal on their own child within a matter of weeks. I mean, what flips a parent like that? I mean, I don't know. I'm baffled by the whole damn thing.
Yeah, there's a lot that, you know, my guess would be these folks are not terribly psychologically sophisticated. And putting those two, kind way to say it, right?
I love your statements. You know, that's technical for nutter.
Yes.
Yeah, poor judgment. Obviously, as everybody has said, putting your teenage girl in the same room with a problematic, aggressive teenage boy, what was that about? You know, a very bad judgment. This might not have happened if that decision had not been made. And it can be hard for people to sort out loyalties in step families. I mean, that's kind of a consistent theme of, you know, do you love your husband more? Do you love your kids more? And of course, most people say you stay loyal to your kids no matter what. Not everybody is sophisticated enough to you know, make those decisions clearly. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's just got to be this huge whirlwind of disturbing emotions. I can't imagine what these people are feeling like right now.
I'm sorry, Tony, just a quick interjection of one simple thing could have mitigated. There's so many things that could have. Why didn't they just put her in their room? Mm-hmm. You know, I know you're on a cruise, but you know what? I mean, just get over your hormones for a night and just...
Well, she didn't choose that. She apparently had the option to go sleep with Grandma and Grandpa, but she chose not to. That's the story they're telling. That the option was available, and she chose not to.
Controlling narratives is the only thing that was popping in my mind. Yes. As when you were saying, you know, what you're saying leading into this, Tony.
And it feels like Anna's dad is controlling a lot of the narrative, in my opinion, on social media and the statements that are being made. And him speaking for her, for the wife, for Chantel, in a lot of things as well, which I got to say, I don't know how the hell, I mean, from a psychological perspective, how a marriage survives this.
Yeah.
And I don't even know like how you work through this at this moment in time. It's it's a fairly new marriage. This just happened and you're still together. That's the part that kind of also shocks me. Not that you need to go get divorced but I don't know. There's two very diametrically opposing things going on here, and a mother here and a father here, and maybe some space, maybe some time to individually handle this and work through this might be the healthiest choice. I don't know how you do this as a group effort, because I think you're going to have diametrically opposing views on some things just because of the roles that they play, being the mother of the alleged murderer, being the father of the victim. Mm-hmm. Again, it seems controlling, it seems chaotic, and maybe that's exactly what it is, but maybe they don't know any different either. There could be other factors at play here as to why everybody's still together. Not that I'm rooting like go get divorced after your son killed your daughter, but again, it all just feels, it feels like the wagons are converging, and it's not necessarily to get to the bottom of this or to, other than let's bury the son and get all the blame onto him. It just seems like there's not a lot of accountability happening over here for the recipe that made little Timmy to begin with.
Right. Yeah, this would be a fascinating one to have everybody in family therapy, you know, and try to look at the dynamics. Are there dependency issues going on with Chantel as mom, right? Want to get the names right.
I don't know.
She feeling really dependent on this man? And, you know, what is their relationship dynamics like? How have they agreed or disagreed? Because I'm guessing they have not, as step families, don't always agree on how to handle kids with problems. And yeah, I would guess that it's not smooth sailing at their house. It's got to be
crazy.
Tumultuous.
Doesn't happen in a vacuum.
No, and then you also have the custody dispute going on between Chantel and her ex-husband, and the ex-husband's like, "This is a crazy house. I don't want any of my kids over there," basically.
Right.
And so she's trying to watch what she's saying. They're both trying to watch what they're saying, and it's coming out in court filings. But none of it is like all too positive about Timmy. It's just like, "Timmy's the devil. Go away." Mm-hmm. I don't know. This is, I guess, just a look into chaos.
But apparently the grandparents are defending Timmy, correct?
Initially, yes. They've been saying that they can't judge. I'm just paraphrasing here, but they can't judge what they don't know, basically. Let's talk about the uncle for a second. Why the fuck does the uncle want to take him in?
Yeah.
I mean, that's another weird part of all this. Mm-hmm. So mom and stepdad have basically written him off. His biological dad still is in the picture and apparently behind him, or at least being a father figure to him, not necessarily saying he's, you know, believes he's innocent. I don't know what he believes, but he's being a part of his life. And you have the uncle, which we know not much about, but apparently he's staying with the uncle. The hell is that? I mean, should he be imprisoned after murder charges? Yes. This man should no longer be free working at the landscaping business of the uncle. But again, that's another weird dynamic of this. Like, why the uncle? And why with this sort of a charge against you, how is that the best setting for this young man?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Not something I would vote for. Maybe my guess, just making a wild guess about the uncle, he may be the one that sees himself, whether it's true or not, he may see himself as the solid voice in the family who can come in and rescue and do something to fix. That would be my guess. Stepping up, just trying to be a person that steps up.
And maybe that's what it is. I know I'm not trying to disparage the uncle in any way, shape, or form. Again, it's just, it's more chaotic dynamics. And it seems every stone you unturn, every page you turn in this book, it's more chaos, which I think it probably explains as to why we're here today talking about them.
Yeah, it looks like he is living in and working at the family business. I just, it's not much on him. That's what I was doing on the side, is just looking it all up.
Can you imagine being like a client of the landscaping company and you know what's going on in this community and then he shows up to like put in your zinnias?
Yeah.
I'd be like, I don't think so. He's going to have to get off my property right about
I'm not even going to say what they just might have popped over from being in Arizona, right?
Jesus. Yeah. Now, it's your thoughts in the comment section, Substack and YouTube. Feel free to weigh in there. We'd love to continue the conversation there. One more case to talk about this morning. Before anyone knew his name, David Anthony Burke was a kid recording music on an iPhone in his sister's closet in Houston. By 20, prosecutors allege he's responsible for the death of a 14-year-old girl, the alleged dismemberment of her body, and a cover-up that reportedly lasted months. The question underneath everything in this case, what made him? Not the moment it allegedly went wrong, the years before that, the specific conditions of his life that reportedly combined into something no one saw coming. Siobhan Scott is with us to help break it down. Siobhan, David Anthony Burke, he was raised in a household where the only music allowed was gospel until he was 13. And we know the type of music that he ended up making. It ain't gospel. But brought up strictly very religious. Then the internet blew open the doors and these very non-gospel music started coming out, eventually making music about romantic homicide. Nobody in his life is reportedly helping him process any of it, really. When a kid goes from that level of a sexual and cultural restriction straight into the unfiltered digital world that apparently he went into, and you still, I would imagine, if your family is very strictly and staunchly religious, they're probably not changing their belief system just because you found the internet or video games. I mean, what does that turn into here? Because he's not learning it from his parents, school, or peers. He appears to have emulated some of these ideas or got some of these ideas from the games he's playing or the music that he was listening to that was outside of the realm of the very strict world that he was in. It's like the floodgates open and suddenly you have access to everything. That's kind of probably be a dangerous place for a young, impressionable mind that doesn't really have any sort of tools to navigate it properly.
Yeah. And you know, a couple things popped into my head, two thoughts. Let me not lose them both.
Okay.
One is that sometimes families are very overtly religious, mm-hmm. but there's a hidden dark side, you know, and we see all these people with these religious, I mean, politicians, highly religious. And, you know, I don't need to even name all the names.
Duggers.
Yeah, I was going to, that's what I was thinking.
Robin will name the names.
Yeah, but there's creepy hidden stuff going on that kids may be aware of. So there could be some of that. The other piece is that kids often raised in really repressive religious homes go opposite. The minute they turn into teenagers, I had one client who was raised very strict Mormon. Her mother wouldn't allow her to wear a bathing suit as a little girl. I mean, everything was so controlled, no television. And what did she do at 13? She ran off to LA to become a hooker. And I had her as a client a few years later. So, so you can have that oppositional effect too. But adolescence is the period of brain sculpting, where identity, values, integrity, empathy, where this really develops. And if you're spending, I mean, I know he was doing homeschool. How much time in homeschool was actually spent online, you know, with parents not really paying attention, which is also very common. And we know that online life, technology shapes social development. It shapes values. It shapes identity, and he certainly went off track somewhere.
So, Siobhan, I'm going to kind of flip an optic potentially and ask you this. So, let's do glass half full with the parents, that they weren't hiding the darkness with their religiosity, their extreme religiosity, if that's what they had. But they was really what it was on the surface. And he hit that point where David wanted to kind of rebel against that, like we've seen in places like the Duggars, and other cult-like mentalities. But what's the likelihood then that he can then recruit the parents based on greed? Because that's, I think IBLP, I think, you know, Jim Bob had the greatest of intentions when he did that, but he got caught up in the almighty dollar and then started turning a blind eye to the abhorrent behaviors of his abusing one accused and one convicted sons. You know, is that a possibility? Have you seen that happen where greed overwhelms the religiosity?
You know, I have not typically run into it personally with my cases, but I think in the media, when we see these awful outcomes and the whole influencer culture, it's definitely having a huge impact when people are getting this kind of money and a sense of power, you know, that goes with it from their kids' behavior. It also, going back to not terribly psychologically insightful and not coming from a place of integrity with, you know, what is this doing to my kid? It's like they just don't get it. They're missing some pieces.
No critical thinking again for the win.
Well, and especially with the integrity and values, because if you're being brought up in a culture that is super strict, like you only listen to gospel music, and I'm sure there's other restrictions that are reminiscent of that surrounding that, and you're held in this cage of we're doing it because we have integrity and these are our values. And then suddenly, he gets into music. And then the person who has also been sitting there telling you and being so strict on what you can and can't consume starts seeing, again, this is my conjecture, that looks like it might be a little lucrative over there. Oh, look, he's making a little bit of money. Look, he's getting a little bit of attention over there at that. Mm-hmm. And then that person that instilled those values into you, and maybe you still believe them or not, but you're exploring the outside world, yourself with your own autonomy, and then that person that still represents kind of the base, the rock, if you will, of the integrity and the values that raise you that way, is suddenly kind of also being like, that's okay. I'm going to encourage this now. You're like encouraging the same shit that it was like, this is the outside world. We don't participate, you know, with all those folks, is now kind of about it. That to me, I think would make one have questions about their own sense of integrity and values. If the people who are closest to you and have shaped you and you viewed as being kind of rock solid turn out to be quite moldable, a lot more like silly putty than a solid rock of values, if you will, which then as you're trying to form your own values, I would think make those even probably more dangerously moldable because you don't have guardrails. You're just basing everything off of what you've been taught in your home your whole life so far. I'm wondering how much of the playing fast and loose with the morality rules from the parental standpoint then had an effect on David and in a way indirectly enabled him to find a path of going on Amazon and buying a burn cage and two chainsaws as a solution to the problem of the 13-year-old he knocked up, allegedly.
Yeah. The greed, I think, not only from parents, but the people around him who were, you know, his entourage and people trying to latch on to his fame, that does pollute thinking, and it's unfortunate, but again, a lot of people don't have insight. They're not monitoring themselves. And it also means when people were making money or saw the promise of gaining money and power from him, they're not confronting problematic behavior anymore. And it's sort of like he gains as a young person who's, you know, really got poor judgment and lack of integrity. Nobody's challenging him.
When you're brought up with that level of strict outlook on life, the religiosity and such, of fire and brimstone, this is horrible if you participate in it, blah, 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 blah. And then you do cross into the world of the sinners and you're doing some things that are not good. And you've been told, it's instilled in you of just how horrible the consequences are to your actions that you know that you have participated in. Does that fuel the motor even more to cover up a murder, to do more things to conceal, to protect, to hide, because of the shame that might be instilled in you for all those years of everything that you were taught, and also to protect from the inner shame you may have, but then the shame of those finding out around you that were the religious figures that you are now letting down? I'm wondering how much of all of that has a fueling effect to this story, if he did it.
Yeah, it's an interesting idea. I know based upon my hyper-religious upbringing, I would never, you know, even consider murdering someone and cutting their body up. But that's just me. I would kind of lean toward maybe he never bought into it.
Okay.
That, you know, there are kids raised, young people raised in homes where there's that kind of family going on. But really from the get-go, they're rejecting it. They may be playing the game and going along with the parents, but it's never really integrated into them as part of their reality.
And I think, you know, to the fueling part, I think David, you know, again, innocent until proven guilty, is so broken as the nature part, that the nurture part was just fueling it. Because there's, I know, I'm just going to cite one example of someone who seemed to make that transition fine. You know, you can have your own personal opinion. But Katy Perry, you know, her father was a pastor. She grew up in a very religious household, and she made that transition just fine, you know, and kind of rejected that lifestyle and, you know, didn't go out murdering people and had enough checks and balances because she wasn't broken to begin with. And so I really think David is just a very, very broken individual, you know, from the nature part and then the nurture. Kept throwing kerosene on this thing, and then the greed kicked in, and then we really saw how well linked again, pure conjecture, the parents were to their religiosity. I can't even say that word. Because then the mother's like managing the money and taking everything in her name. I mean, so if they were so rejecting of the things he was doing because of their religion, why were they so closely bound to it? Anyway, just interesting.
I think that's the question. Yeah, I mean, it's a question. I mean, they have been fighting off with subpoenas or some, I forget what it was, with the grand jury for quite some time. And I get it. I mean, you're going to want to insulate yourself, whether you have anything to hide or not, because anything can be used against you. But I don't know. At the same point, too, if you don't have much to hide, I don't know. There's a lot of questions here, and it's a lot of things where I'm not going to the parents and going, you're responsible for this. But I think there's a lot of shame, I think, that would probably naturally happen to anybody if your kid goes out and does this. Whether you were a good parent or a bad parent, you're going to be looking for every possible thing. Did I cause this? Did I do something wrong that may have driven them to do this or that? And you may be able to put your finger on it and go, shit. It was the extreme religiosity or whatever it may be. I mean, you can go, well, I was totally wrong there. This is horrible that this is how this affected that person. It's not how you intended or what you thought it would be, but it in fact is, you know, it is the result, the cause and effect, whether you intended it or not, as so many things in life are.
Look how different this is, because we just covered the Anna Kepner case where, you know, the son accused of killing his stepsister and the parents, whoop, we're done with you. And this one, son's accused of killing 13-year-old, and the parents are like, not doing that. Interesting, isn't it, always?
Yeah, I think there's some are somewhat similar overlaps, though, too, of insular behavior and you
controlling
know,
narratives.
Controlling the narrative. Mm-hmm. And I mean, they're human. They're going to do it. Not saying it's wrong, but it certainly, I think, would lead to more answers about where these people come from and what's in the recipe.
Where they come from.
What are the seven herbs and spices that made up this person? Because,
another family. I would love to have everybody in a room and go over the family history and watch the way they interact with each other and how they, what stories they tell that explain all this. And again, it makes me think of people who are not terribly insightful.
Siobhan, you would have the best reality show of all times if you could, if we could set you up in a room with all these families and call it Family Therapy Live.
I'd be up for that. I would be up
with
for
all,
that.
With Nutter's Live, something like that.
Would be the most telling way to figure out the dynamics of these people in a room without like putting them on the spot, without asking questions where they're going to lock up? Would it be like playing a game like Monopoly or something and just observing the interactions? I think that would be very telling.
What's Siobhan's opening gambit? What does she put out there first?
How would you bamboozle people to find out what's going on in their brains, Siobhan?
No, I would just, you find so much from people. Tell me the story. Yeah. Tell me the story of your family. And you can pretty much tell who's got a different story from who else's story. You can see who dominates. Yeah. You can see the rationalizations. And just letting people talk. You know, you make a safe space for them to open up and talk. You don't really give feedback when you're gathering data. Mm-hmm. Probably a lot like law enforcement. If you
it's exactly what we do when we're interviewing anyone.
Yeah.
We're building sources. Same thing.
Yeah. Yeah, just get them talking, and I take notes on everything people say, and you start to see patterns.
Yeah, it's another fascinating case. Your thoughts in the comments section on Substack and YouTube. We'd love for you to weigh in with your thoughts. All right, that's going to wrap up this edition of the program. Siobhan's latest book, Nightbird, available wherever you get books. Go check it out, and also available on audiobook. And Robin's latest, It's Not All About Me, also available wherever you get books, also available on audiobook.
And we both read it, too, and I smile every time you mention Siobhan's because I love that book so much.
Yes.
And yours is very, very useful.
Go and check them all out. Until next time, for Siobhan, for Robin, for Todd, I'm Tony. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.